Hello, everyone. Welcome to our second episode of the podcast. Today we have a new member with us, Fadlan. We are going to introduce ourselves, but we do have four members now on the squad. So we're really jazzed about that, and we think Fadlan will bring us a lot of new ideas to the table. Fadlan, let's start with you. Introduce yourself and tell us about how your holiday break is going.
Well, I'm from MST. Big surprise here. For my holiday break, I mostly spend it like working out, doing some writing. I've been trying a little bit of meditation lately. I think it's been pretty productive. I'm mad excited to be on this podcast.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you. Yeah, and that's awesome that you're doing meditation. I definitely think that meditation and writing go hand in hand. And V, we're going to go to you. And yes, MST is a common theme. V is another MST student. So go ahead, V.
Hi, guys. I'm V, also known as Vaishnavi. My holiday break has been, I've been trying to exercise, and that lasted for about 2 days.
It's definitely how it happens. I think you see when you go to the gym in the beginning months of the year, it's like everyone's New Year's resolution to work out. And then like a few months later, no one's there. Go ahead, Mayuka.
Hey, guys. I'm also very excited to be here. My winter break has been pretty chill. I'm now a self-proclaimed Christopher Nolan fan, and I've watched The Prestige last night, and it was really, really good, and I definitely recommend it. Apart from that, I've just been doing henna, working on college app.
The college apps are coming out of the wire. Yeah. All right, we're going to move to the analysis for today. A good man is hard to find. This is a monstrosity of a piece to take into your hands. I definitely think this is one of the pieces where there's just the most to pick apart and where people tend to disagree, even from the critic level to the high school level. Let's get some initial thoughts. And V, why don't you start us off, and then we'll dive right in after everyone shares.
Yeah, sure. So this piece struck me as very odd because she didn't really bother with like varying sentence structure. I also found that she didn't try to make certain aspects of her piece subtle, whereas I feel like other writers would have done that.
Yeah, it's really weird. I think Flannery O'Connor is definitely playing a lot with our minds here, and something just doesn't feel right in the piece.
I definitely agree with you, Sam, that there's like debate on really the basics of this piece. So it's going to be fun to get into that debate. I agree with V as well that it was written not like as a high level, but that was intentional. I think there's a lot of nuance to every single character in here, and that's something we're definitely going to need to go through. Just from their names to their lines, there's a lot to analyze.
If there's anything to describe this story for me, it would just be weird.
Yeah, for sure. I think O'Connor wants us to anticipate, whatever we define as a normal progression of fiction and a clear style. I think there's just really, the style is unclear in this piece, which is very, very unusual. If there's anything an author usually wants you to know, it's the style, but O'Connor is playing with realism and surrealism here. And is able to evoke this slight discomfort. It's not at all obvious, but it is there. I wanted to talk about actually the first line, because you get the line, the grandmother didn't want to go to Florida. Now, we well know that O'Connor is capable of writing something far more elegant than that line. Perhaps she didn't want to go to Florida. You giving the grandmother a name would have been more appropriate. Something a little bit more flashy is needed there, but the grandmother didn't want to go to Florida. To me here, we're already getting a sense of like how perspective and this ambiguous narrator isn't really appropriate. It doesn't feel right to have that lack of persona in this. We just have this totally detracted voice. And it kind of sounds like, you know, your dad winding up for a bedtime story. It doesn't feel like, top level fiction. And O'Connor, you have to think that's intentional.
Yeah, since the first sentence or the first paragraph are usually the hook for the reader, I think that making the choice to not make it very elegant works effectively.
So a few other weird lines in this piece where you definitely feel like the writing is subpar. You have her son Bailey didn't want to arrive at a motel with a cat, which is to me oddly specific and also not really that unexpected. I think a lot of people wouldn't be comfortable with that, and it's almost like it's just very you know, it's true for a lot of people. It's really not as profound as it seems like it's trying to be. And then you have also, this is probably the funniest example, but when the car flips over, the children get out of the car and they go, oh no, we've had an accident. Like, okay, it's not like, ow, my leg. It's not like screaming, you know, like I'm gonna die or anything like that. It's, oh no, we've had an accident. Something about that, it's just, it's like a fever dream. Something is blurry here, something's not right. And then finally you get this, as intense as the parrots on his shirt. So the narrator was referring to the parrots on Bailey's shirt. As intense as the parrots on his shirt definitely feels like a weak simile that O'Connor knows way better than to use.
Like, it's not very profound writing at all, I would say. But I would also like to characterize the grandmother as somebody who's inherently selfish.
We can kind of go through all the characters here. This is, characterization is a huge, huge aspect of the story.
So first of all, the character names, right? So the grandmother isn't actually given a name. She's kind of the protagonist, right? She's kind of the main character. We see the most of her. The children's mother, right? She's also not given a name. Bailey, John Wesley, June Star, they're all given names. That should indicate something as well.
There's definitely a statement here that's made about who O'Connor wants us to like. We get the title, A Good Man is Hard to Find. Well, I think there's definitely an irony in that, and that, you know, if you look for a good person in the story, they're nowhere to be found. There really isn't one. And so out of all the characters, you have the baby, who's a non-entity. You have Haram and Bobby Lee and the Misfit, who are all murderers, the Misfit being the main one. You have Bailey, who's rude to his mother. And you have, you know, the children's mother with no name, doesn't change clothes, there's no form of expression. She's just kind of dead behind the eyes. The same can be said with Red Sam's wife, who gets cut off, and Red Sam, who's rude to his wife. The Misfit has a nickname, but no name, and then is, of course, the lead murderer. And the grandmother is jaded, you know, always using that, you know, back in my day it was this way phrase. She even mentions that she should have married someone because of his wealth, but he died soon after she knew him. So she's like prioritizing wealth over love. June Star and John Wesley are snotty. If you're thinking about having a child someday and you read this story, you might just change your mind, because these children are about as bad as it gets. So who in this story is possibly, you know, can we be drawn to and can we find to be protagonist?
I think this does beg the discussion of, like, what exactly is a protagonist. And I mean, you can look at the dictionary definition. I do believe that two definitions come up. One is like the person that we champion for, the one who we want to win. And another one is simply just the character who's focused on in the story, the central character. And I'm more inclined to believe the second one, because while Sam's right, there's nobody in this story that we really want to root for, I do believe that the story centralizes on the grandmother. We go into her thoughts a little bit. We see how she's ashamed of some things, how she's essentially the root of the problem here in this story.
Well, I definitely agree with you, but I mean, if we're talking about finding someone in the story who we connect with and who we are actually sort of rooting for in a way, then I would definitely have to say June Star, which was one of the children, because I sort of admire the way that she is, the way that she doesn't have a filter on the things that she says, especially to the grandmother, because I feel like a lot of people, and for good reason, are told to, you know, not say certain things out of a fear of hurting someone's feelings or anything like that. But I admire her for her boldness, especially being a girl.
Now, I do want to say in response to that, do you think that's necessarily a good thing, that she doesn't have a filter?
I think that because she's a little kid, she can get away with it. But if we were to talk about, like, her future and her growing up and stuff, she would definitely face a lot of problems with that. At least that's what I think.
Oh, yeah. And there is a part in this story, though, you know, what really steers me away from wanting to like the children is they go from obnoxious to almost evil with the inhumane line, but nobody's killed. You know, they said in disappointment. So, you know, that's really rough to digest. It's like these kids go from, and it doesn't even, again, it doesn't feel natural. Nothing about this is authentic. Why are they so blatantly against what's the right thing to do?
So moving on to kind of the definition of a good man. So like Sam said, you really can't find one in the story. I mean, the grandmother tries to identify a bunch of other people as the good man, but then those definitions are kind of varying. So first with like Red Sam, right? There's a quote, a good man is hard to find. Red Sam, he said, everything is getting terrible. I remember the day you could go off and leave your screen door unlatched, not no more. So it seems like from this quote, it's like, oh, a good man is someone that's a good Samaritan, you know, someone like a good neighbor. But then for the misfit, I think it's a little bit weird because she calls him her own baby. And I think she relates being a good man to having emotions, I guess, because he is like looking like he's about to cry or something. And then she like touches him, right? So that's like a climactic moment. And I think in that moment, you know, being one of her babies is kind of associated with being a good man. So what do you guys think about that? Just the definition of being a good man itself.
Well, I do want to ask, anybody can answer this. Do any of the characters think that they're good people?
I think that the grandmother does, definitely. And she also thinks that Red Sam is a good person because of the similarities between them when they had met.
To go back to the initial question that was just asked about, you know, the whole good concept here, definitely good versus evil is a central theme to this. You know, and it's one of the central themes. There are a few. I think that the statement that might be made here by O'Connor is that, you know, society's constructs of good and evil are far too polarized. They're artificial. They're limiting. I think O'Connor is saying there's a lot more overlap between good and bad than we might think.
Why do we think the grandmother thinks she's a good person? Other than, like, she's real selfish and all that. I kind of want to point towards her appeal towards God when she's talking to the misfit. Like, does she believe that having a belief in God, having that Christian spirit in her, makes her a good person?
I think it's a big part of what makes her think she's a good person, but maybe not all of it.
I think also where she's from, like her generation, is inherently in her mind better than the next generation.
Yeah, definitely.
She's very, she clings to time, which we see a lot of people do in this piece, in different ways. So you have the misfit who clings to his upbringing. He's like, you know, I think he says something like, dad had a heart of gold. And the mom was like, you know, a wonderful person as well. And he really does love his upbringing. But then we do get, and we'll dive deeper into this a little later on, but I think we do get a sense of a desensitized nature in him by some of the events he's seen. So we talk about he saw someone burned alive. He was buried, which is definitely something that critics like to talk about a lot, where potentially the misfit could be a prophet in this scenario where the misfit is already dead. But I do think that there is kind of a lot going on here with that idea of people clinging to their past. The grandmother uses clinging to her past to define good and bad in these totally artificial ways. Red Sam seems to do that as well. Like, no one's nice anymore. But really, they use that as a sort of self-justification, like, because of when they were born, they're automatically exempt from a critical lens. I actually do want to take this time to shift to something that really is the meat of this piece. And you can't really go deeper into analysis without defining where you stand on this. I do believe that this is sort of a surrealism that's happening here. I think that there's a sense that the people in this piece are already dead at the beginning, which is a big statement to make because I think a lot of people don't read it that way at all. And I think that if they are dead at the beginning, you read everything else very differently and you draw sort of figurative elements from literal things in this piece. I think that potentially if they're dead at the beginning, there is this circular progression of this piece where there's no definitive end and beginning. You could almost read this piece backwards in some ways, though few it might be, nothing really changes. There's this sense of, okay, maybe that death they read that happened, you know, in Florida, and involved, you know, the misfit, maybe that death was their own that they're reading about. And I think that could be an explanation for a lot of the clunky syntax, clunky diction, and just poor writing on behalf of O'Connor. Why does this thing make you so seasick when you read it? Why is this distorted reality? Why is that necessary? What are your all's thoughts?
I mean, I don't really want to speak for Baudelaire or V, but I think that is a little bit overcomplicating it. I think it might just be going in chronological time too, possibly.
Yeah, I definitely agree more with Mayuka, although Sam, I do see where you're coming from. But I think that having the family be dead at the beginning of the passage and having the whole piece just be one big circle of events might be a bit of a stretch for me to believe.
I'm slightly torn because I do think there are some instances in the story that could be classified as very surreal and sort of ethereal in a sense. But I am sort of tied to the idea that this is just a chronological story. But I would like to say that there could be some sort of focus on the grandmother here, even in like a surreal sense. Like, I would sort of interpret it this as the grandmother reliving past events. And perhaps that's why Sam would come to the conclusion that the family that was in the newspaper would be them. Because some characters in the story are unnamed, such as the Bailey's wife, the baby. And I would sort of connect the dots here as to perhaps the grandmother doesn't care about these characters nearly as much as her own son or her or his kids.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think right, because we get the perspective, so we have the ambiguous narrator, but you know, there are these details that really pick and pry at you, because there, it seems like, though we have the ambiguous narrator, our perception is skewed in a way that's almost like we're put behind the eyes of the grandmother. It is skewed, and there's like, I think it's like we're using her peripheral vision almost. There are these deeply rooted biases where you get details such as when Bailey says right before he's killed, he was like, "I'll be back in one moment, Mama." And it's like, whoa, Bailey has been a horrible person to her the whole time. And then he's like, "Don't worry, Mama, I'll be right back." It's like, whoa, this grown man who has been terrible to his mother the whole time just show like this childlike nature. Is that what he said, or is that what the mother wanted to hear? I think that the grandmother is really, really distorting our perception here. I think we get a lot of her perspective, even though it's from a ambiguous voice.
Yeah, and that line is even more jarring, because just, I think it was a few seconds before that, the grandmother actually identified the misfit as a criminal, and the son actually said something to her that made her cry and actually made the misfit blush.
And one thing I wanted to ask you all about, I did want to point out that there was a 60s television series known as The Twilight Zone. I remember, you know, hearing stories about my dad, that playing in the background of his childhood moments, and it was a really popular show for a time. And there was an episode called The Hitchhiker. And in this episode, someone's driving along. It's this woman. She's driving along, and she repeatedly sees a guy with his thumb out, you know, asking for a ride. And she's driving across the country, and she sees him about every 100 miles or so. And she's like, "How is this guy catching up to me?" Ultimately, we find out that the lady was already dead. She was in a car crash, and that death came by to pick her up. Coincidence? I think not. Because this was written in 1953, and that was written in 1960. So, it's pretty compelling to me. What do you all think?
Are you saying that the misfit could possibly embody death?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's not a rare concept, because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me, Emily Dickinson, 1890. I mean, we've seen this for centuries.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It's definitely not uncommon, like in The Book Thief.
Now, that's not to discredit, her work here, O'Connor's work, because this is original as heck, regardless of how you read this. It's very, very profound. So even if it is an exhausted concept, that doesn't come across to me. I think this is still very, very original.
Yeah, and it would probably also just be one of the first.
I'm not entirely married to that idea concerning this story, however, because if we were to say that the grandmother was already dead in this story, and from your interpretation, the misfit was a prophet, why would we be shown the aftermath of her death? Like, after three bullets were shot into her chest, and we see the misfit's reactions afterward.
Well, I would argue that the aftermath, there is no clear line. I would argue that them reading, what is the aftermath? Because in my view, there is no aftermath. This is a circular story. So them reading the newspaper is the aftermath. Them reliving it is the aftermath. It never ends, in my opinion.
Where's the beginning? Where's the end?
Right, right. It's very interesting. I think one thing we could all agree on, I remember talking about it a few days ago when we first read this piece, and for some of us, it wasn't our first time. We had read it many times before, but kind of reuniting ourselves to this piece, we had some disagreements about the significance of the line, "Oh my gosh, you're one of my babies," which is the biggest head-scratcher probably in this piece, even more so than some of the iconic lines that come out of the misfit's mouth. I kind of want to go around here and hear some different perspectives on that line, because there are just so many possibilities.
I would like to say that line that she says, I think it's her last resort to appeal to the misfit in order to save her own life. Like, she's just been shown as such a selfish, self-absorbed character that it's perfectly in her characterization to do something like this. And being vulnerable and appealing to emotion, in my eyes, is a really pathetic thing to do, but it's perfectly within her line of work to do that.
Oh yeah, desperation, absolutely. I can't say I wouldn't do that. I mean, you know, we easily say like, oh, we'd come up with some like brilliant response. We'd take this guy aside. We'd psychologically analyze this guy in our head and come up with the perfect thing to sway him not to kill us. But the reality is, the misfit knows she has different beliefs about what good and bad are than him, and it seems inevitable.
I mean, I agree with Fadlan in the sense that she's been selfish throughout this whole piece, and to me this is obviously her continuing that cycle of being selfish and thinking about like how to get the misfit to trust her and how to get the misfit to lower his gun. But I also think that it's kind of warranted here a little bit, because the fear of staring into the barrel of a gun.
Oh yeah.
And so I know, like, if it were me, I would just start bawling, I would beg, I would like do anything I could to just get them to let me go.
Actually, that's a tip that they give a lot, like a safety tip, where if you yell out your own name, it kind of humanizes you a little bit in the eyes of whoever's, you know, endangering you.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So this is kind of, arguably a good move to sort of humanize him, or like, I don't know, pander to him sort of, which she has been doing, almost just flattering him and saying you could be a good person, you gotta pray, like all that stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's like a totally, you know, absurd move on her.
Yeah, I know. So we've heard desperation so far. We've heard, and really just majority desperation, maybe some hysteria going on. But what I was more drawn to is the potential that, okay, if you read it the way I do, where there's like this surrealism, they're already dead factor in there, maybe she recognized him because she's already dead and this has already happened. That's one possibility. Another thing you get is, at the beginning of the piece, she said, if she ever brought her son into the hands of a murderer, she couldn't answer her conscience. So perhaps This is parallel to that line, and that she is losing touch with her conscience. She's not making sense because, what do you know, Bailey is in the arms of a murderer, and she has done just that, which is, we're going to talk a lot about the blatant foreshadowing in this piece. I mean, it's perfectly parallel. And then one other thing is that we have to remember, well, actually two other things. We got the shirt that the misfit is wearing is actually Bailey's, as I understand it. I think this is probably the least plausible, but still within the plethora of possibilities here, where you have the shirt that is her son's on the murderer who's going to kill her. So, oh my God, you're one of my babies, you're one of my children. So there is like this, there's a reading there. And then also, he's a prophet. So maybe he's been tinkering with her fate all along. We know that prophets are inserted into real life scenarios to answer the requests and rulings of some immortal being. So potentially that's a reading of it too. And also, what do we think about the misfit's take on religion? What is the relationship the misfit has with religion here?
I almost feel like he's resenting the grandmother for putting her religion and her beliefs onto him.
I think it also might just be because he doesn't have a very good outlook on Jesus or, you know, God. And that whole, like, monologue that he goes on and how it says Jesus was the only one that ever raised the dead. And he shouldn't have done it. He'd thrown everything off balance. If he did what he said, then it's nothing for you to do but throw everything away and follow him. And if he didn't, then it's nothing for you to do but enjoy the few moments you got left the best way you can, by killing somebody or burning down his house or doing some other meanness to him. No pleasure but meanness.
Wow. So that's a huge, huge statement that perhaps O'Connor is making herself here. We do wonder how much of each of these characters is O'Connor's perception of morality in the real world. But that whole he threw everything off balance, maybe, so the misfit's ideas about Jesus definitely play into O'Connor's positioning on the topic of fate, which is another big theme here, because the misfit believes that people are doomed to be punished whether or not they do anything bad. Because if you recall, the misfit said that he got in trouble with the law for, they said he killed his father, but his father, he said, died of the epidemic flu. So there was that whole reading where the misfit was like, okay, I'm going to be punished anyway. So, and he said, this is what happened to Jesus. Jesus started this way. Jesus was punished for something he didn't do. And what did that do? It instilled in people the promise that if they were to do good things throughout their life, they would go to the afterlife. And so is that really good at all? Perhaps that's what O'Connor's asking here. If you do something simply because you know you're going to get a reward from it, is it really all that good? Or is it a self-serving, selfish notion? What is good and bad here? Is wanting to go to the afterlife by doing good things really all that much better than doing bad things because you don't believe in the afterlife? And he said, that's why I sign myself now. The misfit admits to his crimes himself because he feels he's going to be punished anyway, which is a really, really interesting statement by the misfit here.
You can almost just make a whole origin story for the misfit from that whole line.
And then you have like the iconic line, there never was a body that gave the Undertaker a tip. That, man, that's like, you almost like the misfit here. He's a genius. So there never was a body that gave the Undertaker a tip. So an Undertaker is someone who deals with dead bodies. So we gotta know that. There never was a body who gave the Undertaker a tip. So the misfit saying that the grandmother, in my view, is already dead because so she's doomed for punishment. I think she's literally already dead. And she was dead at the beginning of the story. So he was like, there never was a body that. So let's take those two words, body. So he didn't say somebody, he said body, as in corpse. And he also said that, which doesn't mean who. It means you're a that, you're an object, you are a thing. So he's saying there never was a body, someone who was destined for punishment, which he believes anybody is, whether it's warranted or not. He said there never was a body, a corpse, who gave the Undertaker, who offered the Undertaker money, which she just did. She said, I'll give you all my money if you don't kill me. He said, there never was a body, someone who's destined for punishment, who gave the person who deals with dead bodies money. never happened because there was no bribery. It was inevitable that you can't resist death after you're already dead. That's my reading of that.
So, Sam, let me ask you a question. So the way that you've understood this piece and the way that you've comprehended it, do you see the grandmother dying and or getting murdered as her punishment, or do you see her reliving that over and over again as the punishment?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I honestly think that her reliving of it isn't so much the punishment, because we talked about the role of her peripheral vision, a slight, you know, just like a little slit of her perspective that's in this. I honestly think it's almost her going back and trying to justify it all. I don't think it was the punishment. I think that was more for the reader. That's a statement about fate that that O'Connor's making here, where she's like, you know, there's this whole role of things happening over and over again, you know, where people who are killed really were destined for it all along. So it's kind of like, I think the role of it replaying is not for any of the characters or for the grandmother. It's for us. It's for the reader to say, because the death already happened, the fate is determined. The grandmother is already dead. Therefore, she has to, if she's going to look back at her life, she has to relive it. If she were like some kind of ghost or, you know, like a fantasy creature, I think that she does have to look at it a certain way. And I think that that's O'Connor's way of saying, we know that when you're already dead, your fate is rigged. Of course, if you were to look back at it, you have to look back at it the way it happened. I mean, you can't change the past. But O'Connor's saying, to what extent actually before the, you know, something like this has occurred, do we have control over it? She's drawing a parallel. What kind of free will do we have? And what's interesting is society's statements about good and evil and these overarching ultimatums, they're forming our perception. So I honestly think O'Connor is saying, to some degree, we were dead the moment we came into this world because we never had our individuality. Our individuality was stripped by society's perceptions. So, and that's why the grandmother cannot live, and that's why our fate is to some degree not our own, and that free will, to a degree, perhaps isn't as there as we think it is. So, it's interesting.
I kind of have an issue with that, though, because if as you say, we don't really have free will, and like there is some sort of determination for our fate in the end, like, what's the purpose of going through it all then?
Well, I think we do have free will. I just think O'Connor's saying, like, I think it's more like a figurative thing where she's not like literally someone else is calling all the shots, but it's like she's taking this very, very, remember, this is all an exaggeration, but I think she's taking, again, this fantasy element, this surreal element, to expose the bare bones of reality. It's surrealism as a catalyst to realism. So I think she's like showing us all these things that don't exist so she can play with our minds and open our eyes to something we've never seen before, which is how much of an impact does society have on the decisions we make, which is really, so I think we have free will. It's just that we are social creatures, and there is like an immense peer pressure and an immense like dent in our perception that society makes.
So I actually want to move on to a line that appears much later in the piece, and it says, "She would have been a good woman," the misfit said, "if it had been someone there to shoot her every minute of her life." And I think that that line is really, really interesting because it sort of plays into your idea, Sam, where he's sort of talking as though he's been there for every moment of the grandmother's life, and he's sort of been watching her like fate, or like the god of death, or, you know, a greater power. And it's also kind of funny because he's sort of casually talking about how even in her last moments, even as she was about to die, she was sort of being selfish, and he's saying that if only she was under the barrel of a gun and only if she was that afraid for her life all the time would she ever be a good person. And I think that that's really interesting.
I wonder why she was smiling up at the cloudless sky.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, that was weird.
I mean, I think that's kind of like unsettling and gory.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's very weird. Very unsettling.
So she half sat and half lay in a puddle of blood with her legs crossed under her like a child's and her face smiling up at the cloudless sky. I have no interpretation of that. Why was she smiling?
Well, I think, okay, so you get this almost like this rigor mortis type thing where your body does all kinds of weird stuff the moment you die because it like stiffens in certain ways. But also, that kind of takes you back to right before she got shot. And we'll talk about this moment a lot more, that snapshot in the piece. But why, she said, why, you're one of my babies. And then she was like, oh my gosh, you're one of my children. And that's when she had to die. We'll talk a lot more about that. But I think to answer your question, Mayuka, the smiling there potentially refers to what she was thinking when she said, you're one of my babies. Was it pleasant for her? Or was she so overcome by fear that her brain just glitched and she was just like straight up like happy all of a sudden? Like it's very, very weird. Or maybe she believed it. Maybe she was like, oh my God, you're one of my babies. You're not going to kill me. And then he shot her 3 times in the chest.
I think it just might've been too sudden for her to react to him shooting her. And so she just was in the state she was right before that. When she said, you're one of my babies, you're one of my children, that just, I guess, made her happy or something. So maybe she just like couldn't react.
I want to connect that line back to the, she would have been a good woman if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life. I think at this moment, she might be a good woman. Because she is believing that the misfit is one of her babies. And perhaps we can conclude that because of that, she feels like a good person inside. I don't know, something along those lines. And it would make sense because at this moment, the misfit does shoot her. So it's as if like her final moments in this plane of existence is her being a good woman.
He shot her after she said, or she was expressing like a really nice sentiment, I guess. And I guess that kind of humbled her, sort of humbled her enough to become a good woman.
But does she actually become a good woman, or is she just acting like she's a good person because of the fear of getting shot? And I know that right now we're talking about her after she's passed away, but just in general, does you acting like a good person out of fear, or saying nice things to someone out of fear, does that make you a good person?
I mean, I think you would need an opportunity after that incident to prove that if you were a good person or not. And the grandmother here wasn't given that opportunity to prove it. So I think that's more of just a debate rather than like a finalized answer.
So, I mean, do you guys think that she died as a good person?
No, I don't. And the interesting thing is here, when we talk about the smile that you all are talking about, it's kind of like, to me, it's the realization. She's like, holy crap, I've already been through this. This is happening a second time. And it's that satisfaction of the realization, I am already dead and I've recognized you. That's how she dies. And it's almost like she has to be shot at that moment. And I'm not going to pivot there to the full strength yet because I want to talk more about this line. She would have been a good woman had she had someone to shoot her every day of her life. But it is interesting because, like, I think maybe it was just the satisfaction of her. And it's just a microsecond before he shoots her. But I think it's just the satisfaction of, I know what's happening. I finally understand why it's like this. And then she dies.
Well, I sort of interpreted her smiling up at the cloudless sky as just O'Connor making a contrast between the grandmother's life before her death and the grandmother's afterlife. Because while she was alive, she was sort of portrayed, at least in the section, or at least in this piece, as really bitter and really selfish. And I think it's a great distinction to make.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what's interesting? In you repeating that line, a cloudless sky, what's significant about the fact that it's cloudless? Perhaps if there are no clouds in the sky, there's a clear sight to God. Because if you're religious, you believe that God is up there. So if you're lying on your back and the sky is cloudless, it's that direct eye contact with the afterlife. Perhaps that's what's happening as well. There's nothing in her way anymore.
Is that justice, though? Because she was only a good person in the final moments of her life. But what about literally the rest of her life? She has, in my eyes, so much to make up for. So does that interpretation make sense in the justice standpoint?
No, I don't even think she's good here either. What do you all think? I mean, I don't think she's, like, even a good person when she dies. I think she's desperate. I mean, or hysterical, or, like, again, it's that surreal reading of she's already died and she recognizes it. But what do you all think?
I definitely think that at the end, even her intentions were corrupt.
Maybe she thought she was going to see heaven when she died in those moments. Maybe she thought she was going to get away with being vulnerable to the misfit. And maybe she died thinking that.
Yeah, and we think about how much her character leans into the past. What is more comforting to someone who leans into the past than leaning into the fact that they're a mother? You know, it's like, I've raised the child, you're my baby, it's going to be fine, because that's the mother's nurture. And before we dive into talking about that snapshot where she gets shot, what's going on in the misfit's head, why did that have to happen at that point? I do want to explore this line that V brought up a while ago. You know, she would have been a good woman if she'd had someone to shoot her every day of her life. So to me, what that says is if she had received her inevitable punishment more frequently, she would have thought more like the misfit, because her concept of good of evil wouldn't be so, from his view, messed up and polarized by society. So he's like, if she had injustice to put her in line every day, perhaps she would be able to live like me and understand that there's no pleasure but meanness. And, you know, it's interesting because it's like to shoot her every day of her life, for her to receive her punishment every day like the misfit already had. He was like, if she was, you know, already dead like me, or already punished like me at least, perhaps she would not have walked right into this trap.
What are y'all's thoughts on the last lines? Like, right after he says she would have been a good woman, the misfit said, if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life. Then it goes, some fun, Bobby Lee said. Shut up, Bobby Lee, the misfit said. It's no real pleasure in life. I don't really know how to interpret some fun, Bobby Lee said, but so it's no pleasure in life basically means there's no pleasure in life. There's not actually real fun or anything. You're not really living to get any pleasure. What are y'all's interpretations of that?
The misfit contradicts himself with the distinguishing of pleasure and meanness so many times in this piece. It's annoying almost, where if you actually like sit down with this and dissect it, he said like earlier in the piece, so he's like, there's no pleasure but meanness. You know, that was just said here. But we have to wonder, are the misfit's crimes sadistic? Does he actually get pleasure from them? Because remember, he said earlier in the piece, like, if there's no afterlife, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but if there's no afterlife, you might as well just walk around burning down barns or whatever and, like, committing meanness. But he's implying there that that's pleasurable. He's like, you might as well just enjoy yourself and, like, kill everyone. But he said no pleasure but meanness. So perhaps, now he's saying it's no pleasure in life. I thought that the meanness was the pleasure. I thought he got pleasure from his meanness. But now he's saying it's no pleasure. It's no real pleasure in life. So maybe the question that the misfit is evoking here is pleasure as a result of, the desire to inflict pain on others, sadistic crimes, is that really real pleasure? Or is it just plain meanness, and pleasure should be more tied to doing good things and seeing the smile on someone else's face? That could be the case.
I think that maybe O'Connor is also sort of hinting that real pleasure in life should be more intrinsic, because the misfit here was talking about inflicting pain on others, and that other people would need to be involved in order for there to be pleasure, but maybe that's not the case in real life.
Yeah, I mean, he seems like he has it pretty thought out. I mean, it's interesting how O'Connor, the one person in this piece who's most reflective and thoughtful, is the lead murderer. So everyone else is just like, they're not a murderer, but they're also really obnoxious, and they kind of point out the flaws in ourselves. But this misfit guy, who is like our raw definition of the most evil person possible, has these desirable traits about him. So it's something to think about.
But then you could also argue that although he seems, you know, really articulate and well thought out and like sure of himself, he is kind of trying to rationalize this thing that we all know to be wrong, you know? Like, there is not really a right or wrong. You just do what you do, and if you do something that other people consider wrong, you get punished. You know, that's it. I don't think it's a really popular opinion among people.
I think the likable traits about the misfit are a facade. Like, I agree with Mayuka here that he's trying to rationalize these actions of his. Like, he's trying to convince himself that what he's doing makes sense, basically. And he's trying to add on the no pleasure but meanness part of that to further that rhetoric. Because, as shown in, like, earlier in that story, he said that he was wronged. He was severely punished for something that he didn't do. So he does all these nasty, evil things in order to try to make up for that. And with him saying that there's no pleasure but meanness, he's trying to rationalize those actions of his. But I think that line at the end here, there, it's no pleasure in real life, I think that's another side to him. As in, perhaps he's realizing that maybe doing these evil actions, maybe they can't be rationalized.
It gets a little icky too, because it's like, usually, you know, this likable trait and stuff can be seen in, you know, common serial killers like Ted Bundy. Everyone was still attracted to him. He had a certain way of, you know, speaking, and no one really thought that he was dangerous or anything, right? So that's definitely qualities in a narcissist and a serial killer. And yeah, it's definitely not uncommon.
Well, yeah. And like, sometimes we just can't, like, the only thing scarier than a murderer is a murderer that has likable traits about them. If we want to think of real world examples, it's painfully true that, like, you can see in prison interviews of one of the most unimaginable criminals with just these horrid desires. And Jeffrey Dahmer, that kind of a person, when he talks, it's very normal. He did have friends. He was a little socially inept, but like, when he talked, he was like, I was just simply out of control. I had all these things wrong with me. So again, we come back in this scenario, it's a fictional story, but we come back to this idea of these actions are in no way justifiable. And it scares us as readers that someone who does, you know, what is clearly bad can have these desirable and like almost trustworthy things about them. Like, you want to give him trust, but you're just not able to. You have to remember that the misfit is bad, because if you don't remember that, you could easily start to like him.
I have a question for you guys. So the line, I call myself the misfit, he said, because I can't make what all I done wrong fit with all I've gone through in punishment. So do you guys think that he recognizes that his actions are wrong? And in that case, like, would he really have a reason to rationalize anything or try to explain himself to the grandmother at all? Because if he thinks that he didn't do enough wrong to go through that much punishment that he did, you know, what was the point of saying all that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he says specifically he's not a good person. She's like, you think you're a good person, right? And he's like, no. He's like, I'm not a good person, but there's no point in being a good person if there's no afterlife. He's like, I'm just going to go around doing bad things. There's no friggin' point to it, because society has it all wrong. So, yeah, he doesn't care to rationalize it. He's just like, I've been punished for so many things I haven't done that now I have to catch up by doing things that are punishable.
Yeah, Sam, and I think that the misfit sort of admitting that he's not a good person and that he's done things that are wrong and he's not redeemable, does that sort of make him a little bit better than the grandmother, who is also, like, bad in a way, and I'm in no way comparing like her selfishness to murder and all the horrible things that the Misfit has done, but does the grandmother is still thinking that she's, you know, a good person and thinking that she's a good Christian, does that sort of in that sense make her a worse person than the murderer?
I mean, in his eyes, because like his idea of good is like understanding the system. He's like, it's understanding that you're going to be inevitably punished, so there's no point in being law-abiding or abiding by the morals that society, you know, establishes. Because he's like, you're going to be punished no matter what. You might as well defy, you know, the idea of good. So it's like a completely different thing. He was like, she would have been a good woman if she had gone through enough punishment and understood that it, like, there wasn't an afterlife and it wasn't, like, worth it to go around trying to be law-abiding and stuff.
So to shift gears to the other characters, I wanted to talk a little bit about Bailey. He seems kind of like the head of the household, sort of, but he's trying to be. He's not necessarily that way, though, because obviously the children don't respect him in any way. I think maybe the children's mother, again, she's not given a name. She's sort of unimportant in Bailey's eyes, really the author's eyes, because, you know, she's not given a name, but also in the grandmother's eyes.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And I sort of resented the grandmother at the beginning because while I was starting to read it, I sort of had it in my mind that the grandmother, that the whole piece was from the grandmother's point of view and that she was the protagonist in the piece. And so when she gave her son a name and she called her son by his name and didn't call her daughter-in-law, the mother of the children, by any name, and continued to not give the mother a name, it sort of already made me not like her.
Yeah, one of Bailey's more significant lines that I found, like, you know, totally elusive was, nobody realizes what this is. Because what he's referring to, or seemingly referring to, is nobody realizes how bad our car accident was. Like, you shouldn't be like pointing a gun at us right now, you should be trying to get us medical help, making sure we're all right. He says nobody realizes how bad this is, and I kind of got goosebumps when I read that, because I was like, you know what, you're right, I don't realize what this is. And there is this dramatic irony about this piece where you feel like you see something that the characters don't, the audience knows something that the actual characters do not. I don't think anyone does realize what this is. I think it is a replay. So Bailey, that's one of his more influential lines, I think.
I can't believe we didn't talk about this yet, but, you know, the racism in the piece, the N-word is used a lot, right? And we can, of course, see the grandmother's obvious racism with the whole boy that ate the watermelon.
Yeah. I mean, and I honestly think, so it's definitely, you do have to consider the time that this was written, because when we read this today, we're like, okay, we see this kind of racism, we're automatically drawn to it. We're like, that's the core of this piece, is addressing that racism, because it's so prominent right now, so top of mind right now, such an issue in addressing our modern racial strife, specifically here in the U.S., and with the movements that have been going on recently and trying to address it, you know, and just wondering when it's going to end and stop manifesting itself as something new every decade. It is easy to read this piece that way, but when you take the time into consideration, in my view, about race, it wasn't a core theme. I think, like, it to me, it's just really our generation's reading of it, and there isn't really, the fact that the piece was written in 1953, we look for it, but everything about it is going to be racist because of the time, and it should be noted how racist it is, and, like, the progression of racism historically should be noted and we should observe it, but it's also like hard for our generation to grasp that it isn't a core part of this piece.
What was kind of the relevance of it then, apart from just characterizing the grandmother as someone who is racist and also, you know, selfish and greedy, with the whole story of Mr. Edgar Atkins?
Since it was 53, I think that, like, especially for an old lady, that was the norm, unfortunately. What is, like, totally racist and forbidden to us is just, like, moderately, like, maybe don't say that, or, like, she's just crotchety. They're like, man, this old lady, like, she's always making those silly remarks, but today we're repulsed by it. But, like, in 53, people were probably just, like, you know, kind of, like, this is before the civil rights movement really kicked in. And we're in the South. I mean, you think about, like, Emmett Till, you know, a lot of stuff happened in the South leading up to the civil rights movement that were just absolutely repulsive. And that's why I just don't think O'Connor was really thinking about it all that much, other than characterizing the grandmother as, like, crotchety and also reflective and trying to remember her past and stuff.
I do sort of think the author tries to paint some sort of racist outlook on the grandmother, because not only is the N-word used, but there are also racial stereotypes used in the Edgar Atkins anecdote here with the mention of the watermelon. I would understand your point if it was just the N-word being used here, but having this racial stereotype being included as well does have me leaning that O'Connor wants us to see the grandmother in a racist negative light and sort of start to characterize her, since this is early on in the story.
Yeah. As much as I want to believe you, I definitely think that there is this, like, so one thing that you think about what old people have done, you know, always is talk about the past. They're reminiscent. They're nostalgic. And if their past is, like, just a load of racism, like, a lot of it, like, you're talking about the plantation, you know, like, the watermelon, the way she treated people in the past, landmarks, just, you name it. I mean, it was all there. I kind of feel like this could have been the grandmother just, like, talking about her past, too. I definitely think, yeah, and potentially Fadlan, it is, like, it was intentional. It wasn't, like, I wouldn't call this, like, a racially activist piece. Like, I definitely don't think it's a core theme, but potentially, like, it's part of O'Connor's intention. I just think that it could also be just the grandmother being nostalgic about her past, which is just, like, inherently racist. Like, everything about it is.
I think it relates more to a core theme of class, maybe. That could also be said for someone who's just less educated, you know?
Oh, I was just going to say that I think that maybe the grandmother's use of that language was maybe O'Connor just establishing another distinction between the grandmother and the rest of the characters in the piece, because I don't think any of the other characters used, like, that kind of language or anything like that. So I think maybe it just shows, like, her personality as opposed to the other people in the piece.
So as we talk about the significance of the grandmother, we also see that the character is somewhat parallel to some of the thoughts shared by Red Sammy. And Red Sammy is debated by a lot of readers of this piece about, like, what is the significance of Red Sammy. I mean, he, like, this is an actual part of change in setting here. Like, it's a sort of pinpointable, like, part of the piece where they stop at the restaurant, Red Sammy mistreats his wife, and it is parallel with, like, you know, the other characters who are also dislikable all in their own way. But is there a significance of Red Sammy beyond just stopping by the restaurant? Any thoughts?
I think that maybe Red Sammy's mistreatment of his wife sort of speaks on the grandmother and her husband's relationship, maybe?
Yeah. So is he, like, a character of, like, affirming things we kind of already see? Like, he's just a pattern that we see? Or, because obviously the misfit is, like, shattering pattern, where he's, like, if we think about the main characters here, the misfit sticks out. But Red Sammy feels like he should be a main character, but there's nothing really, like, profoundly different that I noticed. But I was wondering if you all did about Red Sammy.
Yeah, I think also maybe it speaks to, like, the grandmother's sort of superiority complex, where she's, I don't know, she seems like the person to be constantly thinking about, oh, well, I'm a better person than this person, or this guy doesn't seem to be, like, that good of a guy, you know? He's not really a good man. And Red Sam, although he has certain similar characteristics with the grandmother, I feel like he's not said to be thinking about that all the time, you know? So maybe it struck him as odd that she even asked about being a good man.
I think there's a line I sort of want to focus on here. The grandmother says to Red Sammy, she calls him a good man, and he responds with, "I suppose so." I kind of want to understand why there's so much doubt with that answer.
I mean, he could have just been like, "Stop it, you know, like he knows it, but he's just kind of like trying to be humble. Like, it's like that kind of half-hearted, like, I'm going to be humble type thing. But there might be another reading. So one of the big devices I think O'Connor utilizes here in this piece is the obvious foreshadowing throughout it. I think what's so common among fiction pieces is to make, like, hints subtle. I mean, like, pretty much all hints are subtle in fiction. I mean, you get this discrete little progression of events. But in lines like, even earlier in the piece, the grandmother said that she did something in the car to, like, in case there was an accident. That was, like, one of the biggest giveaways. Like, she was like, "I'm just preparing, like, just in case." Like, that's really interesting. Red Sam's wife, she's like, "I wouldn't be surprised at all if he," and then there are ellipses because she was talking about the misfit, and she was like, "I wouldn't be surprised if all," and then, like, "at all if he," and then she got cut off because Red Sam, like, was like, you know, "Get back to the kitchen," or whatever, because he's sexist and hurtful, and so he, you know, removed her from the situation before she could speak a truth. So what I want to ask you all is, why would O'Connor make it so blatant? What is the point of that?
Well, I mean, it could sort of play into what your perception of this piece is, Sam, where it was just every character's sort of some subconscious remembrance of all this stuff already happening. And so that could be a really interesting topic to explore.
Yeah, it's definitely like, this seems like it's below O'Connor, you know, to do these things. So, you know, they're intentional. There is like, she's almost like, she's not playing down to us at all. There's like an even more complex thing behind this. Not that all creative writing has to be complex if it's a classic or if it's good. I mean, certainly not. Simplicity when in order is wonderful too. And has to be masterfully done. But I think that, like, this could be perceived as simplicity even. But maybe that, and I want to hear your all's response to this, but maybe that blatant foreshadowing was supposed to set up that dramatic irony, you know, where the audience knows something that the reader doesn't. And then that was designed specifically to raise questions in the reader's mind about whether people choose their fate or their fate chooses them, because this could be iterated by the fact that, like, the characters are living their own death and can't change the past that is their present. So you get the sense that this idea of blatant foreshadowing, it's like so obvious to the characters, even like that this could happen. Like, you're like, how does it not occur to them that all of this is a bad idea? How do they not understand what's uncomfortable? And then it comes back to that overarching theme of fate, where it's like, is it just meant to be? Is it society shapes us in such a profound way that we underestimate people like the misfit and we run ourselves right into these situations because of the fact that society, you know, distorts our perceptions of good and evil, and we kind of just disregard what they read in the paper? Fadlan, a few days ago when we talked about this piece, you and I remember you mentioning to me that there was a part where that was significant in this piece where the grandmother reaches out and touches the misfit. And we're kind of moving over here from what is very obvious about this piece to what is, like, totally mind-boggling. And you kind of made the connection to, you know, the snake bite, the venom maybe associated with that. And I wanted you to kind of expand on that for us.
All right. So what I thought about this incident in this story is that as the grandmother is trying to be vulnerable, trying to appeal to the misfit's sense of emotion, reaching out to him, the misfit sort of takes this all in. And in that moment, he give me a second. he notices that the grandmother calls him one of her babies. And what I'm thinking here is that the misfit does not want to be compared to the grandmother at all. In the misfit's eyes, he's nothing like the grandmother. They think on completely different wavelengths. So hearing this is sort of a shock to him. And I sort of want to compare the grandmother's sense of vulnerability, the misfit's comparison to her. When she reaches out to him, it's sort of like an actual snake bite. Like the venom is sort of seeping in him. And he shoots her 3 times in the chest because he doesn't want to be related to her in any sort of way or fashion.
Yeah. I think one other takeaway potentially, and again, this was kind of under my reading, the surreal reading. But so we think the venom, yeah, is the poison. So maybe as the grandmother touches the misfit, it gives him who, like, potentially isn't actually an individual. There's a confusion about that. Is he a prophet? He's not actually, like, just a regular individual living his life. So as the grandmother touches the misfit, it gives him physical properties, which means she shattered a wall that can't be shattered. So all of a sudden, he can no longer exist to her. Therefore, he is poisoned by the venom and dead to her. That's one reading of that, because when you reach out and touch this guy, it could be your reading where he's just, like, offended or scared that she would, like, try to get that close to him. But he's also kind of like, man, I wish that she had kind of picked up on the whole, like, rigged life thing regarding punishment and how it's inevitable. But he was like, she's too far gone, and I can't let her shatter the difference between her mortality in relation to his immortality, and just kind of how she can't shatter that barrier. And maybe there's some truth to that, but maybe it's also like the more literal reading that's more plausible.
I think another interpretation, just given the context, like him calling her lady, I don't think that's really a term of endearment when he calls her that. I think it's more like annoyance, like, I'm like putting up with you, you know? He's like tolerating her and like amusing her almost, like humoring her, preaching to him about praying and like religion and everything. And once she goes out and like reaches out and touches him, I think that's like the breaking point for him where he's like, you know what, I'm done. You know, I'm just going to shoot you too. Maybe he was waiting for this moment. And it was just, yeah, she just crossed the line.
And this is similar to the whole line that the scene where he says, but it would have been better for all of you, lady, if you hadn't recognized me. Because when she recognizes him, from my view, it could be saying that the misfit was saying that when she identifies him, he's scared that they'll like turn him in if he lets them go about free. So he has to kill them. But then on the flip side of that, it could be because the grandmother was already dead. When she identifies him as the misfit, her knowledge of the present writes her past. And the killing must occur for the two to match, for her present and past to match. So it was just another way of her getting to what had already happened. So he's kind of like, man, that's not going to bode well for you, because now I have to carry out the rest. So, there are two readings there. And again, it comes back to the realistic reading and the surrealistic.
So getting to sort of the syntax of this piece, you see that she uses past tense since the beginning. And you don't really know who exactly the narrator is here, although it's told in the grandmother's perspective for the most part until you get to the end. And like, that's, I guess, the aftermath of killing the grandmother. Fadlan, do you want to talk a little bit about why the past tense would be significant?
I think the past tense is significant because it sort of aligns with Sam's perspective on the story. Because from what he's saying, from what we're saying, like, the grandmother sort of reliving this experience over and over again. So basically, these events already happened to her. It would make complete sense for the story to be told in past tense if that was the interpretation for the story. The grandmother's looking back on these experiences, reliving them over and over again.
It kind of gives a sense of like spookiness, like, oh, this is how it all went wrong, you know, just, you know, even by the first line. Like, the grandmother did not want to go to Florida. Yeah, we thought it was really simplistic in the beginning, right? But really looking back at it, it seems a little more creepy.
Oh boy. That line gave me heebie-jeebies.
And like, there are some things that were originally subtle and then not so subtle by the end of this thing, and maybe after rereading this thing. There was the line, John Wesley said that he'd smack the misfit's face at the beginning of the piece. He was like, if you ever like met the misfit, like, what would you do or something like that? And he was like, I'd smack his face. And later in the piece, the misfit talks about how much children make him nervous. Is that a coincidence? Like, maybe because this thing had already happened, he's already like he knows about the boys' or like the children's intentions to like hurt him and like call his like his basically his men that are, well, what do you call them, his partners in crime, a pig, and they're kind of fearless, but like in a kind of an ignorant way, inexperienced way, the children might be, where they're just pretty fearless as a result of what they don't know. They're pretty innocent. And so I think Junestar also said at the beginning of the piece that the grandmother would have to go to Florida because she's afraid she'll miss something. And think about it, if she doesn't go to Florida, she'd miss her own death. So like, and if this is a replay of what already happened, she literally has to go. Like, she can't miss what already happened because the past is the past. So it's like, it's a really, really weird statement. There are some creepy statements early on.
No, I mean, like, if you don't want to follow Sam's interpretation of the piece, which is getting more and more compelling, at least for me now, even though I earlier disagreed with the whole thing, you can definitely just see that it's just coming full circle, you know? A lot of the lines are connecting back to each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly unpopular, and I'll admit that because, look, like, when I brought this up earlier in the year, like, in AP Lit class, we did it, talk a little bit about this piece, and when I brought that up, it seemed absurd. I remember the moment when I dropped in the chat, now, who thinks that they're already dead at the beginning of this piece? And I just read, no, 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 and I was like, you know what? I feel loved today.
You're converting us, Sam.
I have to admit, though, I'm also sort of getting on board with Sam's theory a little bit. I'm definitely not totally there, but I'm like on the fence between the two.
As we move to our closing remarks on this piece, I definitely want to get a sense of what for you all is thematically significant about this piece, and then also maybe what some of the devices are used here, because I definitely think in creative writing, it's easy to get too academic about it within the school setting because you're trying to analyze, you know, is there symbolism? Is there not symbolism? Like, what about the syntax makes this compelling? Like, it's not real world stuff. But I definitely think there are some elements here that make this impactful, and they're very potent, so we should point them out. What to you all, and we'll start with V and go around the circle, what to you all is significant about this piece, both in what it does and how it does it?
For me, what was sort of significant about this piece is the distinction that O'Connor is making between men and women throughout the entire piece. And she does this first by not giving the children's mother a name, not giving even the grandmother a name, even though she's, you know, a constant throughout the piece, but giving, you know, Bailey a name and giving Red Sam a name. And even Red Sam's wife doesn't have a name. She just remains as Red Sam's wife. And even though this theme wasn't, you know, as apparent as other themes in the piece, it sort of really hit hard for me, at least.
I think that in the beginning, when they're describing, or when O'Connor is describing the grandmother's outfit and like just making her seem very, very white and proper. So in the line, in case of an accident, anyone seeing her dead on the highway would know at once that she was a lady. Right. So that kind of emphasizes the whole theme of class, and how, and also, you know, juxtaposes the whole anecdote with the watermelon.
Yeah, that's interesting, because from today's point of view, there are three compelling things to talk about. None of them, I think, are actually central to this piece, but they are like catalysts to things that are central. So they are the bridge that gets us there. So I do think, and before, like, I give my full explanation, we're going to move to Fadlan. But I think that in response to what you said, Mayuka, there is, like, a sexism that's there. It isn't, like, central as it would be if this were written today. as far as intentionality. I think, like, there's also the class thing where the misfit. So he talks in what we would consider to be, like, the stereotypical, like, unfortunately, there's, like, this stereotype that it's the dumb Southern accent, right? Which isn't at all accurate. And we see O'Connor defying that because the misfit is, like, so intelligent and painfully so because he's gone through all these traumatic events that totally make him a dangerous and immoral person. But he also, the way he communicates his thoughts and how he thinks it through is a very reasonable, reflective, and frankly admirable line of reasoning, or at least style of reasoning. His, like, the content inside of his brain is frankly just plain scary, but I think the way that he gets there is very interesting. And sexism also works to, like, you know, the lack of names for some of the women in here, it also works into some of these core themes. So Fadlan, taking it away, and we'll finish up after that.
Yeah, so what I found interesting about this piece was the discussion and portrayal of good and evil, especially towards the end of the piece. I really appreciated, like, the interactions between the grandmother and the rest of the family, the grandmother and the misfit, to truly explore what good and evil is. Like, does good or does evil originate in human beings when we're, like, born? Like, which one of those is, like, a learned trait? And that's sort of where my mind went towards the end of this story here. Especially with, like, the misfit's point of view on this, like, a lot of what he says is, like, said logically, said rationally, but we still see him as a bad man. But we can also say that the grandmother is a bad person as well, because of how she treats her family, how she's so self-absorbed. And I think a discussion like this is very much worth exploring.
It's the whole nature versus nurture, like, psychological cliche within the field of psychology. The nature versus nurture argument, I know, to psychologists gets exhausting because it's, like, so relevant. How much of our upbringing shapes us, and then what is biological? I do think that's relevant here. But for me, I think when I think about this from, you know, the point of view of, like, just getting down to the nitty-gritty use of devices, I think about the obvious foreshadowing, the unrealistic and uncomfortable syntax and diction, like, just the lack of authenticity in them. That's part of it. And then you get the ambiguous perspective, which is slightly altered by the grandmother's peripheral almost. So there's, like, some overlap there that's kind of spooky and uncomfortable for us. There's the hyperbolized characterization that ultimately, all these things together, they create a story that reads like a surreal fever dream. And that kind of invites readers to consider questioning concepts of fate and good, or fate and good versus evil as social constructs. And really, to me, in my reading of this piece, you kind of, like, you get this idea where by changing our routine perception, readers are given a chance to put our subliminal truths under a microscope, to put their subliminal truths under a microscope and sort of analyze themselves, which is interesting because, you know, when you come back to the title, a good man is hard to find. How do we define those two things? And how we get there, meaning our fate, how we get to defining ourselves, what part of that is shaped by society, and what part of that is our individuality? You see, like, I think one of the things that's interesting is, I think O'Connor might be making a statement, is it's like, when does our death happen? Does our death happen when our individuality is stripped from us, or is it our physical death? I definitely think that, you know, the killing of the grandmother, it's almost like when she loses her individuality and is overcome by what society has taught her, that the misfit says, you know, you can no longer live. And so that's interesting to me.
And with that, we are going to conclude the episode of The Icebox. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and we will see you in the next episode.
The music you hear was written by Manuel's very own Youth Performing Arts School percussionist Aaron Muller. To find more of Aaron's works, check out the description for this episode. The Icebox website invites listeners to submit pieces of their own for discussion on the podcast, or publish pieces they'd like to hear analyzed. Thank you for joining us on the Icebox. For now, I'm Sam Baker. Keep the pen warm, and we'll see you next time.